This is Doug Kay, the host and producer of IT Conversations, and today I'm excited to bring you this presentation by Will Wheaton, delivered at NomeDex 4.0 in South Lake Tahoe, Nevada on October 2, 2004. And here now is Will Wheaton.
Hi, my name is Will W., and I'm a geek. I first discovered that I was a geek in fifth grade when Kent Purser hit me in the face with a dodgeball at recess, and I retreated to the relative safety of the bench with Stephen Beale, who introduced me on that day to Dungeons and Dragons. And from that day forward, I think I've handled polyhedral dice more often than I've handled, well, pretty much any athletic implement since. I'm really happy to be here, and I'm really honored. God, I look like such a dork. I love it that my badge has my website on it. I just think that's really cool. I'm really honored that Chris asked me to come and speak here and allowed me to be involved today. I want to read to you from two of my books. This is the big book, which is called Just a Geek, and this is the little book, which is called Dancing Barefoot. And they're stories that originated on my weblog at willwheaton.net and found their way through various editors and through various internal critics and all sorts of places to ultimately be published by O'Reilly, which is kind of a big deal for me because, as I said, I'm a geek. I'm releasing this performance today under a Creative Commons license. This will be released. Thanks. This will be released under the non-commercial, no-derives, by attribution license. If anybody has any questions about that, you can see me after when I'm done, or more likely than not, ask anyone near you. And I would love it so very much if anyone who is recording this in any form would please put it on BitTorrent, get it on peer-to-peer networks, and get it around. I'm trying very, very hard to take my stories and take my books beyond, the geeks who understand what I'm talking about to a bit of a wider audience. So every little bit helps. So I'm going to begin today with a story about the creation of my website at willwheaton.net. This is from chapter one of my book, Just a Geek. It's called Where's My Burrito? Or A Brief History of willwheaton.net. On a hot June afternoon in the year 2000, I joined my best friend Darren for lunch at one of our teenage haunts, Old Town, Pasadena. An afternoon in Old Town is a trip to a time when we were free of responsibility and the world was filled with possibility and opportunity. The changes in Old Town reflect the changes within ourselves. Thanks to the efforts of the Pasadena preservationists, the historical building facades haven't changed, but they are the only thing that remain the same. The empty doorway where a punk rocker once sneered at passing businessmen is now a pottery barn occupied by a San Marino yuppie who screams into her cell phone. The eclectic record store where we'd buy imported Smith singles is now a Sam Goody, its windows plastered with posters announcing the latest release from Justin Timberlake. Tourists stand uncomfortably at crosswalks trying to ignore the homeless who have come to enjoy the trickle-down economics of a prospering shopping thoroughfare. Incidentally, if I can just break away from the text for a minute, and my wife hates it when I do this, I was in Old Town Pasadena the other day and saw two homeless guys fighting over a street corner. One guy was really pissed at the guy who had just shown up because the guy who had just shown up was in a wheelchair, and the guy was pissed off because he thought the wheelchair guy was going to get more money than he was going to get with his dog. All of this progress is not without its benefits, though. Old Town is safe if sanitized, and several good restaurants have moved into the area. On this particular afternoon, Darren and I walked down Colorado Boulevard following the same route as Pasadena's claim to annual fame, the Tournament of Roses Parade. We passed the Cheesecake Factory, several trendy Japanese noodle houses, and walked straight into Hooters. Hey, Darren was engaged and I'm married. Sometimes a guy's got to know if he still has it. We walked in ahead of the lunchtime rush so we could sit wherever we liked. Through a speaker above us, Bob Seger rhetorically asked, "Ain't it funny how the night moves?" We looked around the mostly empty restaurant and chose the section with the hottest waitress in the joint. As we took our seats, Our waitress came over to our table. A cute but not beautiful girl in her early 20s. Bleached blonde, fake tan, long legs, Hooters. Her name tag said Destiny. She flirted with us as she took our order, all smiles and giggles. We ordered wings. Super fire hot wings, baby. She stood up and left to put in our order. Darren and I stared at each other, grinned, and exchanged a mental high five. Oh yeah, we still had it, and it felt good. She'd only walked a few steps when she stopped suddenly, turned around, and came back to our table. She looked at me, lustily. Can I ask you something? Oh, hell yeah, Willie. The ladies still want your sweet action. My face flushed and my pulse quickened. Sure, I said. She screwed up her courage and leaned close to me, her full, pouting lips just inches from mine. Her perfume embraced me. Her ample cleavage seductively longed to bust out from beneath her thin cotton t-shirt. She drew a nervous breath, bit down on the corner of her mouth, and asked, breathlessly, "Didn't you used to be an actor?" What? Used to be? I still am! Mental images of a hot Hooters threesome were quickly replaced with the cold reality of appearing on Celebrity Boxing. She immediately knew that she'd made a mistake. She thought quickly, licked her lips, self-consciously fussed with her overprocessed hair, and tried again. Oh, I mean, weren't you an actor when you were a kid? All I could do was numbly answer, yeah, when I was a kid, as I hung my head and ordered the first of many pints of Guinness. Funny story, right? Funny like when you watch another guy get kicked in the nuts. In the days that followed, I tried to write it off. I tried to bolster my wounded self-esteem by telling myself that she was just a Hooters waitress, so she didn't matter. But the truth was that simple, scantily clad waitress had driven home with painful acuity my deepest fear. I was a has-been. I used to be an actor when I was a kid. Well, if I used to be an actor, it wasn't for lack of trying, but it was the result of a series of choices I'd made, starting all the way back in 1989 when I was just 16 years old and in Florida for a Star Trek cruise. I used to be on a TV show called Star Trek: The Next Generation. Even though it was early in the morning, it was already hot and humid in Miami. My brother and I stood together in front of the hotel and waited to get on a bus that would take us to the port. There were hundreds of Trekkies swarming around us, and a ripple of excitement went through the crowd when the hotel doors opened and the entire cast of the original Star Trek, minus Shatner and Nimoy, walked out. Most of them looked a little drunk. Some of them looked a lot unhappy. Marina Sirtis, who played Counselor Troi on Next Generation and was the object of a very large teenage crush, came out of a different door and approached us. How are you doing, teen idol? She said. I'm okay, I guess, I said. What's up with them? I pointed at the original series cast, who were now posing for pictures and signing autographs. Oh, they're just having a good time, she said. Oh. Okay, I'll see you on the bus. We are going to have so much fun on this cruise. She hugged me and walked away. My brother pointed at one of the other actors and said, "Dude, he is fucked up," and began to laugh. But I couldn't join him. In 1989, Star Trek was my life. At 16 years old, I was a veteran actor. I worked on the series for 50 hours a week. But I was also a veteran of the Star Trek convention circuit. 3 weekends out of the month, I entertained audiences at Holiday Inns all over the country. When I looked at these original series actors, I saw the ghost of my career yet to come. I had no idea at the time that it's probably not that big a deal to have a few drinks early in the morning while you're on vacation. As a matter of fact, having just gotten back from vacation, I can confirm that, in fact, it is not a big deal at all. I had no idea that some of the Star Trek alumni were quite happy traveling around the country and performing for Trekkies at conventions. It also didn't occur to me that some of those actors, who had only done 3 or 4 episodes, had willingly chosen to live out their lives, recalling their time on the Enterprise. I spoke with the arrogant surety of a 16-year-old. "Look at that," I said. "That's my future if I don't get out of Star Trek and do movies. There is no fucking way I'm going to spend the rest of my life talking about what I did when I was a kid." "I'm going to prove to everyone that I can do more with my life than just be on Star Trek." All my brother could say was, "Dude." Dude was a multi-purpose word. I watched the debates, sorry. "Of course I know it's multi-purpose. I know that." It was a multi-purpose word in our vernacular. Dude could stand in for several words and phrases like, "Check out that hottie," or "Stop talking now because mom's standing right behind you," or, "This is seriously fucked up." "Exactly," I said. A couple of hours later, we were on the ship, and today, after 15 years, all I can recall about the entire 3-day cruise is that conversation. Because at that moment, I made a choice that would drive my life and haunt me for years. I would get out of my Star Trek contract, and I would go on to a huge career in movies. I would prove to everyone that I was a great actor, and that Star Trek was just a small part of my resume. Yeah. Didn't quite work out that way. And it's probably my karma for having such a negative impression of those original series actors, who I have come to know as kind and wonderful people. Actually, I have such regard for them now, I hate to open this book with a negative view of them, but that moment in 1989 was the foundation upon which the last 15 years of my life have been built. I thought about that moment often, especially over the next few years when the writers reduced my role on Next Generation to little more than saying, "Aye, sir, course laid in." And the producers of Next Generation prevented me from taking a major role in Milos Forman's Valmont. As an adult, getting paid thousands of dollars a week to say, "Aye, sir, course laid in," is a seriously sweet gig. It is. But when I was a teenager and had a lot to prove, it sucked balls. I felt like I had to prove to everyone that Stand By Me wasn't a fluke, and I deserved all the attention that I got from that movie. I never considered that most actors go their entire careers without one film like Stand By Me to their credit. I never considered that I could have stuck around on Star Trek right up until the end and then stepped off into a film career like, oh, I don't know, let's randomly pick someone, Patrick Stewart. Because of that moment on the dock in Miami in 1989, I was convinced that if I stuck around until the end, I'd be stepping off onto a dock in Miami in 1999. As it turns out, I'm not popular enough. I've often wondered how different my life would have been if my brother's dude had meant, "Hey, why don't you relax? You're young, and you have your entire life ahead of you. You have an opportunity to work on a great series for a few more years, build up a nice bank account, and then parlay the success of Star Trek into a film career, like the bald guy. But don't quit now, or you will regret it for the rest of your life. And stop staring at Marina's ass. That's just rude." Of course, I'm still talking about what I did when I was a kid. And I never got that big film career I was hoping for. When I was released from my Star Trek contract, I was 18. And, like most 18-year-olds, I knew everything. I realized that I had never had a childhood. And I had never really just gone off and done things that I wanted to do. I also realized that when I looked in the mirror, I saw the reflection of everything I hated about Hollywood and humanity staring back at me from behind angry and unhappy eyes. How did I let this happen to me, I thought. I have to get out of here. In the early 1990s, I vanished from Hollywood and moved to Topeka, Kansas. I spent a little over a year there, working on computers during the day and on my incredibly screwed up psyche at night. When I felt like I'd put myself back together, I returned to Los Angeles and enrolled in a 5-year acting program. I remember thinking that I'd gotten all the way to Star Trek on instinct alone, and if I wanted to move beyond it, I would need some technique. When I was in drama school, I passed on several film opportunities, among them Primal Fear. You may know it as the movie that launched Ed Norton's career. I know it as the huge opportunity that I completely fucked up. When my agent told me that I was making a huge mistake, I told him, "Look, man, I'm in drama school now, and I can't leave until I finish. It's like when Luke was on Dagobah, man, and if he wanted to go to Bespin to save his friends, Yoda told him not to quit in the middle of his training, but Luke didn't listen, and he was never able to be as great a Jedi as his father." I foolishly thought that Hollywood would wait for me. When I graduated from drama school 5 years later, I had a rather rude awakening. Not only had Hollywood completely forgotten me, they'd completely forgotten my type of actor. The everyman was out, and a new type called edgy was in. Let's talk about edgy just for a second. What does that conjure up in your mind? Ask the person next to you what their description of edgy is. And your descriptions won't match, I promise. They won't even be close. Then if you were to talk about it for a minute and see if you could sort of reach an agreement on like what exactly edgy means, you wouldn't be able to do that either. But don't worry, because it's not your fault. I'm going to let you in on a dirty industry secret. Nobody knew what edgy meant. It just sort of meant unwashed. Or, Jesus? If this room fills up with popcorn, I'm going to be very upset. I'll let you in on a dirty industry secret. Nobody knows what edgy means beyond unwashed and unwashed. Well, that's it. I've just spent several unproductive minutes staring at a blinking cursor, trying to come up with another word besides not Will Wheaton, which is really 3 words and more of a descriptive phrase than a synonym. While Hollywood didn't quite know what edgy was, they were certain that I wasn't it. I'm passionate, too smart for my own good, unfulfilled, caring, but I am not edgy. So I spent several years struggling, unable even to book a commercial. I wasn't well-known enough for product endorsements, but I was too well-known to be some random guy extolling the virtues of floor wax. The flood of opportunities I enjoyed when I was a child and a teenager slowed to a trickle, then stopped. I used to be an actor when I was a kid. It was so hard to get work, I often contemplated giving up life as an actor and going back to college. "You have to love the work more than you hate the rejection and the unemployment," my mom said. I did love the work, and I believed in my abilities as an actor. I felt that I could take direction well, and I understood the vagaries of storytelling, those ephemeral things that make an actor's performance greater than the words on the page. I was compelled to act. Well, that compulsion became obsession. Success as an actor had always come my way without any real effort. When I was a kid, which resulted in that feeling of undeserved success. And after I graduated from drama school, I felt like my acting chops were better than ever. And I spent several years just being one big part away from making that elusive comeback. That drove me crazy. I was in my 20s, but I looked like I was in my teens. So I often auditioned to play a teenager. Since I didn't have the same energy or mentality as the real teenagers around me, I never got cast. When I walked into auditions, I was rejected before I even opened my mouth, and I felt like I was wasting everyone's time, including my own. It didn't take long for the word to spread around Hollywood. That guy Will Wheaton might look young, but he can't play young. After countless failed auditions where I was 10 years older than everyone else, I became cynical and pessimistic. The weekend after the Hooters incident, as it came to be known, my wife was out of town, and proof to everyone that quitting Star Trek wasn't a mistake, and I found ourselves in front of my computer. I surfed the internet, played Diablo 2, created Winamp playlists. I did everything I could to get that Hooters waitress out of my mind. Yes, you see, that's how badly it hurt me. I was actively trying to get a Hooters waitress out of my mind while my wife was out of town. Somewhere in that day, while I was battling the forces of polygonal evil on Battle.net, Proof to Everyone tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Dude, you should make a website and let the world know that you're still alive and still acting." I paused the game and looked back at him. I'd wanted a presence on the web for a long time, but I did not have the skills to build a website. Some people say I still don't. I'd been given the names of several designers, but I wanted to do the whole thing myself, for better or for worse. "Oh my God, that's a fantastic idea," I said. "Maybe we'll even get noticed by Hollywood again." "Just make sure you make the website edgy," he said. "If you were real, I would cock punch you for that." I quit the game and went to Yahoo GeoCities, where I created an account called TV's Will Wheaton. Get it? TV's Will Wheaton? Because I'm still on TV, except I'm not? Because I had absolutely no idea how to write HTML, and I knew nothing about tables or CSS or RSS feeds or the W3C. I spent the next few hours clumsily learning my way around the Yahoo page builder. I used their WYSIWYG editor to design my first web page. The result was incredibly lame, but it was mine. I named it Where's My Burrito, after my favorite episode of The Simpsons, Last Exit to Springfield. Within a month, I was blogging almost every day. And even though Proof to Everyone spoke more often than I did, more and more people were stopping by to read what I wrote. Where's My Burrito was a fine place to start, but I was outgrowing GeoCities. I was ready for a real website. So I bought the domain name willwheaton.net and spent the next several weeks teaching myself how to build a website from scratch. Personally, I thought Where's My Burrito had a certain unpolished charm, but Proof to Everyone knew that if we were going to rejuvenate the old acting career, we needed to have a more professional-looking presence on the internet. Problem was, I couldn't afford to hire a designer, and I was afraid that, even if I did, I would end up with a celebrity website, like Melanie Griffith, that would be just a marketing tool. Like Melanie Griffith. Proof to Everyone thought this was a great idea, but I wanted to do something more than that. I compared the entries I wrote in my blog to the entries Proof to Everyone that quitting Star Trek wasn't a mistake wrote in my blog, and I saw a remarkable difference in the responses and the way I felt about them. I locked Proof to Everyone in a shed in my backyard and spent several weeks learning HTML and PHP. I bought a copy of Macromedia Dreamweaver and surfed around the web for design ideas. I looked at celebrity websites, and I looked at personal websites. All the celebrity websites were exactly what I would expect. Marketing tools controlled by publicists and professional image doctors. But the personal sites felt like there was some dude sitting at a computer putting up stuff that he thought was cool. The personal weblog sites gave me a window into the writer's world, and I decided that I would do the same thing. I launched willwheaton.net on August 23rd, 2001. It didn't occur to me at the time, but that would have been River Phoenix's 30th birthday. Word of its existence spread quickly around the internet, and I was asked to give interviews to several popular websites, including Salon, Wired, Slashdot, and BBSpot. Proof to Everyone did most of the talking, but I managed to get a few words in myself. I began to get emails from people I admired, like Asia Carrera. It's true. Friends who I hadn't talked to in years heard about it around the water cooler, or in the chat room, or via the prison grapevine, and got back in touch. Here's an early review of willwheaton.net from Chris Perillo's Locker Gnome, a very popular and respected technology and internet culture newsletter. Stand by him. He was the scrawny writer in Stand By Me, and then he became Wesley Crusher of the Starship Enterprise. If you mention the name Will Wheaton to anyone in my generation, they'll know exactly who you're talking about. I don't think that's right, but it was a very nice thing of him to say. But what has this actor been up to lately? You can find out at his official website, written, designed, and maintained by Will himself. And you want to know what makes it cool? He isn't afraid to kick back and let his hair down. He's actually a pretty funny guy. Just goes to show you that what you see on screen isn't always who that person is in real life. Dude, he always seemed so mellow walking along those railroad tracks. I got a boner when I read that. because I love Locker Gnome. It was so cool. The same week, Yahoo's NetBuzz listed as one of their headlines, "The Triumphant Return of Will Wheaton," which gave me a smaller boner, but stuff. So I blogged a lot. I blogged frequently about all kinds of different things. I talked about my family, I talked about Star Trek, I talked about my website, and a lot of people who apparently had been looking for something to do since the Usenet group Alt Ensign Wesley Crusher die had gone out of... Well, anyway, they found a new place to come and spread the love. I spent a couple of months sort of answering the attacks that I had endured for years and years and years when I was a teenager. Several times I almost gave up the weblog altogether. There were many times when I just wondered if it was even worth it at all. But I really enjoyed writing. And the more I spoke and the less the ghost called proof to everyone that quitting Star Trek wasn't a mistake spoke, the happier I was. I felt really comfortable in my own skin, and I started to figure out where I was in my life and how I'd gotten there. And one of the longer kind of multi-part stories that I wrote for my website was about a Star Trek convention that I went to in Las Vegas in September of 2001. And it was chronicled on my website under the title "The Saga of SpongeBob Vegas Pants." Which should be a very good lesson to all the other bloggers here that you should probably just put some effort into coming up with a good title. Because it follows you forever. When I wrote about this experience in Las Vegas, I discovered that I got to go back in my mind to a convention that was really a good time for me. I had a great time with my wife. I had a great time with my sketch comedy show. I kind of sucked when I was on stage at the convention, but the audience seemed to not hate me by the time I was done. And it was just really, really cool. The compulsion to act slowly but steadily fell away, and the compulsion to write and create began to take over and become more insistent. I listened to This American Life religiously and decided that I wanted to be David Sedaris when I grew up, but not gay and not living in Paris, just like a really good writer. So when I wrote, I tried to hear his voice in my head. The Saga of SpongeBob Vegas Pants is incredibly amusing to me, and I would like to share a couple of portions of it with you guys right now. I spent the first week of September 2001 in Las Vegas at a Star Trek convention which celebrated the 35th anniversary of the original series. In addition to the things we Star Trek people usually do at conventions, like signing autographs and posing for pictures, answering questions and saying, "Engage," I took a group of people from the Acme Comedy Theater with me to perform a sketch comedy show. The entire convention experience is chronicled in the Saga of SpongeBob Vegas Pants, which is in this book. Here's a primer for readers who aren't familiar with Star Trek conventions. Conventions, or cons as they are known among people who just don't have enough time in the day to say conventions, are part trade show, part collectible show, and part geek fest. It all adds up to a celebration of everything related to Star Trek, and the atmosphere is always festive and excited. Promoters hire actors, writers, producers, and others from the show to give lectures, answer questions, and sign autographs for the fans. There are also people who sell collectibles and bootlegs and other sci-fi and fantasy-oriented merchandise. Incidentally, please don't tell my mom this, but the first adult video I ever bought was at a Star Trek convention, and it was a parody of Supergirl. Yeah. Seriously, they should have called it Super Bush, because it was made in like 1975. It was horrible. The organizers usually run episodes of Star Trek on a big screen, and there are always costume contests. Oh, the costume contests. Think Rocky Horror Picture Show, but with less drag. And strangely, more singing in Klingon. Seriously. When I was invited to participate in this show, proof to everyone that quitting Star Trek wasn't a mistake, grabbed the phone out of my hand and said, "I'd love to come to the convention, but I'm in this sketch comedy group that performs at the Acme Comedy Theater in Hollywood, and I'd like to bring some of it to Vegas and prove, show the fans that I can do something different and unexpected." The promoter thought it was a great idea, so I approached some of the funniest and smartest Acme writers and performers about doing a sci-fi-oriented comedy show for some sci-fi fans. The ones who didn't ask me for money or run away screaming came with me to Vegas. The Q&A talk that I gave to the fans was a complete, abject, miserable failure, but my sketch comedy show was a resounding success. Proof to everyone and I were very proud of ourselves, and the voice of self-doubt was temporarily silenced. But that was nothing compared to the experience I had at the Las Vegas Hilton Star Trek The Experience. The following are some excerpts from The Saga of SpongeBob Vegas Pants, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Star Trek. This is titled Occasionally Glancing Up Through the Rain. I check my watch, 4:55 p.m. I'm supposed to go on at 5 p.m. and talk for about 90 minutes. Sorry, I'm supposed to go on and talk for about 50 minutes. You'd think that I would read this before I came here, so I'd be like, oh, prepared. Apparently not. Let's just edit that part out. I check my watch, 4:55 p.m. I'm supposed to go on at 5 p.m. and talk for about 50 minutes. I usually talk for 90 minutes, which gives me time to let the audience warm up to me, tell some involved stories, take a lot of questions, and make some jokes. With just 50 minutes, I cannot waste any time. I have to go out there, nail the audience with a good joke right away, and get them on my side. Well, I've got three things working against me before I even walk into the room. Number one, I'm the last speaker of the day. The fans are tired and a little burned out. Number two, I'm following Michael Dorn and Marina Sirtis. They do conventions together all the time and have a set routine that never fails. The fans adore them. And number three, I was Wesley Crusher. Performing well at a convention is extremely important to me. I care about what the fans think. I don't write them off or take them for granted. I know that they've spent a very large portion of their disposable income on this show, and I want to make sure they get their money's worth. I remember how I felt when William fucking Shatner dismissed me on the set of Star Trek V. That feeling of humiliation and disenfranchisement. Again, I watched the debates. Disenchantment is easy for me to recall, and I do everything I can to ensure that I don't inflict it on another person. When I'm on stage, the only real difference between me and the people I'm talking to is that I got paid to wear the spacesuit. I am a huge science fiction geek. I've been attending conventions since I was in fifth grade, and I know what it's like when a guest is only there to take the fans' money. Notice how I didn't say the guy's name, but I was going there. I pace backstage, checking my watch every 40 seconds. Michael and Marina are really working this crowd, and the fans don't want to let them get off the stage. At 5:15, they finally finish. My mouth and throat get dry. My hands sweat and tremble. I've got the Ernest Borgnine cast, my parents, and my wife in the audience. The last thing I want to do is have a whole room of Trekkies hate me in front of them. Michael and Marina come off stage. Somebody laughed like, yeah, they hated you, I know. Michael and Marina come off stage and smile at me. Marina gives me a warm hug and kisses my cheek. You look great, she turns to Michael. Doesn't he look great? If you say so, Michael says. I love these two. I'm terrified about going on stage, but a smile that starts in my feet spreads across my face. The fans loved you guys, I say. I have a lot to live up to. You're going to be great, Will. It's the promoter, Dave Scott. Are you ready? I take a deep breath. Yeah. Let's do it. Michael and Marina wish me luck and leave. I wonder if any of us have ever stayed around to watch each other on stage. I've watched Patrick a few times, hoping that he'll break into some spontaneous Shakespeare, but nobody's ever watched me as far as I know. Dave pats my shoulder and takes the stage. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, our next speaker is going to really surprise you. The crowd begins to applaud. Well, that was nice, I think. Surprising people is cool. He did a show for me in Waterbury, Connecticut, and it was the funniest, most entertaining, and charming guest I've ever had. The audience is joined by some whistling. Whoa, Dave, settle down, big guy. Let's not build me up too much. You're going to have the time of your life in the next 50 minutes. I hear somebody in the room scream, Wesley! Oh, Christ, the time of your life? Stop! Now, please welcome to the stage, all the way from Los Angeles, the man, the myth, the legend, Wesley Crusher himself, Will Wheaton. The The crowd goes nuts. They cheer, they stomp their feet, they whistle. The stage is littered with women's underpants. All right, maybe not the underpants part, but everything else is true, I swear. I take a deep breath and walk through the curtain. I burst out onto the stage, and they jump to their feet. In this moment, I totally understand the appeal of living a rock and roll lifestyle. I walk around the stage, waving, throwing the goat, and enjoying the positive response. When the crowd settles down, I hit them with my funny. It's very hot in Las Vegas, like 10th circle of hell hot. Fortunately, TNN, which is now Spike TV, has shown up, and in a humanitarian and self-promotional effort, have handed out bottles of Altair water. Plain old bottled water, but it's in this nifty green bottle with some Star Trek graphics on it and a friendly reminder to watch TNG on the new TNN. They were handing them out by the hundreds because those spacesuits really make you sweat, if I remember correctly. So I hold up the bottle of water and I say, I've been drinking this Altair water all morning, and you know what I'm thinking? This isn't actually from the planet Altair. It's just regular water. So if you paid for it, I think you got ripped off. Oh yeah, baby. Comedy gold. The applause and cheering of moments before is replaced by the hum of fluorescent lights. As the very first surly heckler shouts, "It's free, Will." The voice of self-preservation speaks up, "Get off the stage right now. You had your chance, and you blew it." He's right. I've been on stage for 15 seconds, and they already hate me. I try to shake it off, and I move right into the Q&A. Okay, only have 50 minutes here today, and I want to maximize our time together, so here's the deal. I've got some stories that I like to tell, but I also like to take questions from the audience so you can direct the discussion. Apparently, when I'm on stage, I talk like a carny on speed. Since we only have a short time today, I'll answer the most frequently asked questions first. No? Yes? Umbrellas? I can't remember. And they were real. Oh, bingo, baby. They were real. Come on, how can they not love that? Silence. I see a teenager in a sexy Women of Star Trek t-shirt roll his eyes as four Klingons sigh heavily and walk out. Oh, shit. They're walking out. I'm dead. I panic. What's wrong? I ask the voice of self-preservation. Hey, I told you to get off the stage. You're on your own, jackass. An experienced performer has a few jokes or stories that always get a good response. We call them back pocket material, and they're held in our minds for occasions exactly like this. I decide to bring one of them out, but my mind draws a complete blank. I have nothing to say, so I say, does anyone have any questions? I honestly expect someone to shout out, "How come you suck?" But nobody says anything. I look at the crowd for a second, and I say with a smile, "Well then, I guess we're done here. Thanks a lot for coming, and have a great rest of the weekend." I start to walk off the stage with every intention of continuing down the hall and straight into the bar. After a couple of steps, though, they all laugh hard. What? That was funny? Apparently after the water crack, I set the bar fairly low. Okay, I'll take what I can get. I relax a bit and we get going. I begin to share my Star Trek memories and the crowd gets involved. A woman dressed as Dr. Crusher stands up and says, "Say hello to your mother." Okay, I say, and turn over to my real mother, Debbie, who's sitting on the opposite side of the theater. "Hey, Mom. Thanks for coming. Do I still suck?" The whole room turns to find her. "No, honey, you're doing great," she says. "Thanks, Mom." A ridiculously cute girl who wears a baby doll social distortion shirt speaks up. What was it like to kiss Ashley Judd? I smile broadly. Come on up here and I'll show you. Huge laugh. She stands up. No, no, no. I'm kidding. I hold up my hand and point into my palm. My ifway is a in a the eater thay. I glance at my wife. She's laughing and shaking her head, and she winks at me. Okay, I feel good. They're laughing with me, and we're having a good time. I call on an older man who sits near the front, several bags of collectibles at his feet. Do you have a favorite episode of Voyager? Well, the truth is, I've only watched Voyager a couple of times, and I really don't like it. There's a bit of a gasp. Did Wesley Crusher just say he doesn't like Voyager? Is that what I heard? Because that's what I'm pretty sure that Wesley Crusher just said he doesn't like Voyager. I try to explain. Well, yeah, the episode was called Scorpion, and I watched it because my friend designed the monster that terrorized the crew for the entire episode. I hear angry sighs. People turn to talk to each other. Some of them leave. What happened? All I said was I don't like Voyager. What's the big deal? A lot of Trekkies don't like Voyager. Maybe I should have called it V'ger. A guy waves his hand rather urgently, fingers spread in the Vulcan live long and prosper salute. I point at him. What was your favorite episode of Deep Space Nine? Well, the truth is, Deep Space Nine and Voyager just never really appealed to me. The stories didn't interest me as much as the stories on Next Generation or Classic Trek. Big mistake. This is not what the fans want to hear. They want to hear how I love and care about these shows as much as they do, because that's exactly what they hear from the other actors. The other actors get up on stage and they give the fans exactly what they want. I don't do that. I tell them what it's truly like for me, warts and all. And the truth is, sometimes being on Star Trek was the greatest thing in the world. Other times, it totally sucked. And as blasphemous as this sounds, at the end of the day, it was just my job. But when all is said and done, I am still a fan at heart. I loved the original series. I am fiercely proud of the work I did on Next Generation. I cried when Spock died, and I saw Star Trek IV in the theaters 6 times. I failed to mention all that, however. Without that information, it can seriously piss people off that I don't have the same unconditional love for Star Trek that they do. I look at my watch. I have 10 minutes left to fill. I've got nothing to lose, so I reach into my back pocket and find it filled with material. Thank you, Jesus. I have a limited edition Star Trek Monopoly game, I say. Of course it's a limited edition of 65 million. But it's extremely valuable because I got a number under 21 million. They laugh. It's funny because it's true. I go one better. Plus, it's got a certificate of authenticity signed by Captain Picard. Yeah, that's right. My Star Trek Monopoly game, which I've rendered worthless by opening, comes with a certificate of authenticity signed in ink by a fictional character. I see a guy in the front row say something to his buddy, and they both nod their heads and laugh. Cool thing about the game, though, is that there's a Wesley Crusher game piece in it. And the first time I sat down to play it with my family, my stepson Ryan grabbed Wesley and proclaimed, as only an 11-year-old can, "I'm Will! I'm Will! Nolan, I'm all-time Will! I call it!" I see some people smile, and I start to pace around the stage. I'm hitting my stride, and the stories flow out of me. One time when we were renegotiating our contracts, we were all asking for raises. We all felt the salary increase was appropriate because The Next Generation was a serious hit. It was making gobs of money for Paramount, and we felt that we should share in that bounty. Of course, Paramount felt otherwise. So a long and incredibly annoying negotiation process began. During that process, the producer's first counteroffer was that, in lieu of a raise, they would give my character a promotion. a lieutenant. What? Were they serious? From the back of the room, a guy hollers, "Yeah! Lieutenant Crusher! Woo!" My agent asked me what I wanted to do. I told him to call them back and remind them that Star Trek is a television show. Okay, that, very risky to say. I'm pretty sure that it's the opposite of just a television show to these people, but I've gotten the audience back, so they giggle. I imagined this phone call to the bank. "Hi, I'm not going to be able to make my house payment this month, but don't worry, I'm a lieutenant now." "On the Starship Enterprise." "Enterprise D." "Yeah, the new one. Feel free to drop by 10 forward for lunch someday. We'll put it on my officer's tab." There's laughter and applause. My time is up, and Dave Scott stands at the foot of the stage, politely letting me know that it's time for me to go. The fans see this, and I pretend not to notice him. In 2001, StarTrek.com set up a poll to find out what fans thought the best Star Trek episode of all time was. The competition encompassed all the series. The nominated episode from Classic Trek was City on the Edge of Forever. The entry for Next Generation was Best of Both Worlds Part 2. Deep Space Nine offered Trials and Tribulations. And Voyager weighed in with Scorpion 2. As I name each show, various groups of people applaud and whistle, erasing any doubt as to what their favorite show is. Now, look, I know that Star Trek's just a TV show. Matter of fact, I'm pretty sure I just said that 5 minutes ago. But there was no way I was going to let my show lose. It just wasn't going to happen, especially not to Voyager. V'ger. I pause and look out at the crowd. So I went into my office, sat at my computer for 72 straight hours, and voted for Next Generation over and over again. I didn't eat. I didn't sleep. I just sat there, stinky in my own filth, clicking and hitting F5, a Howard Hughes for the Next Generation. Sometime around the 71st hour, my wife realized that she hadn't seen me in a while and started knocking on the door to see what I was doing. "Nothing! I'm working!" Click, 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 click. "I don't believe you! Tell me what you've been doing at the computer for so long." I didn't want her to know what I was doing. It was really embarrassing. I'd been sitting there in crusty pajamas, voting in a Star Trek poll for 3 days. Some people make gagging noises. Some people go, "Ew," but it's all in good fun. They are really along for the ride now, and it feels great. She jiggled the handle, kicked at the bottom of the door, and it popped open. The audience gasps. I hurriedly shut down Mozilla and spun around in my chair. "What have you been doing on this computer for 3 days, Will?" I look out across the audience and pause dramatically. I lower my voice and confidentially say, "I was not about to admit the embarrassing truth." So I quickly said, "I've been downloading porn, honey! Gigabytes and gigabytes of dirty, filthy porn!" I have to stop because the ballroom rocks with laughter. It's a real applause break. She was not amused. "Tell me the truth," she said. I sighed and told her that I'd been stuffing the ballot box in an online Star Trek poll. "You are such a dork. I'd have been happier with the porn." "Really?" "No." She set a plate of cold food on the desk and walked out, muttering something about nerds. I stayed in that office for another 10 hours just to be sure. When my eyes began to bleed, I finally walked away. It took several weeks of physical therapy before I could walk correctly again, but it was totally worth it. Best of Both Worlds Part 2 won by a landslide. I pause dramatically, and the theater is silent. And it had nothing to do with my stuffing the ballot box. It's because Next Generation fucking rules! I throw my hand into the air, and the audience leaps to their feet, roaring with applause and laughter. I cannot believe it, man. I got them back. I say thank you, give the microphone to Dave Scott, who is now sitting on the stage, pointedly checking his watch, and exit stage left. Now I'm out of water. It was the worst Star Trek convention experience I've ever had, and then it was the best Star Trek convention experience I'd ever had. Later that night, my sketch comedy group and I performed a show for them, for the Star Trek fans. We sold out a room. We sold 500 tickets, and then they had to like make tickets on paper and sold them to people to stand in the back of the room. It was the best thing ever. It was really risky and scary for me. I'd been doing the sketch comedy show at Acme for months, and I knew that the material was funny, and it always played very well for audiences in Hollywood, but, you know, I mean, these people know me as Wesley Crusher, and I've got a sketch in the show where I just sort of hump a bed the whole time, and I think it's really funny, but I was scared to death that that wouldn't work. Then I have another sketch called Shut Up Wesley, where I'm working at, where I play myself working at an office building, and all the people in the office building think I'm really Wesley, and that I'm really on a secret mission from the Enterprise, and I just think they're like kooky fans. And in the thing, I kind of freak out at them, and I end up killing them with a real phaser. This sketch always killed when I was at Acme in Hollywood, but it was really dangerous to do this sketch for Star Trek fans because I didn't want them to think I was making fun of them. I was really making fun of myself and hopefully making fun of Hollywood a little bit. But when that Shut Up Wesley sketch started out, I could really feel the audience like, oh, wait a minute. Is he doing Get a Life to us? What's this about? And by the end of it, they were cheering and stuff. And if you're playing the Nitro Zack and Snaggy Joy of Tech drinking game at home, grab your beer now, because I cried when the show was over. Because I had proved to myself and I had proved to everybody else in there that I could do something different, that I could do something, you know, unexpected. And I took a huge, huge, huge risk, and it totally paid off. I never finished the saga of SpongeBob Vegas Pants on my website, just because I'm lazy. And I did eventually release it in Dancing Barefoot, and there's more. I'll read you one more chapter if I have time.
We're going to take a break in this presentation by Will Wheaton so that those of you who are copying this to CDs have a chance to stop and start a new one. I'd like to take this moment to thank the sponsors who have made this coverage of Gnomedex 4.0 possible. They include Magnitude Music, Limelight Networks, the providers of our content delivery network, DecisionCast, ZDNet, our media partners, and the producers of the event, Yahoo and Locker Gnome. Thanks to them very much. We'll be back with part two of this presentation by Will Wheaton.